Support comes from Assisted Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are socializing in ways that could not have been imagined a few decades ago when, even then, many turned to the wisdom of Emily Post to learn what to do in a given situation, for example, at the dinner table. In 1947, it was as easy as switching on a film strip. Here's Emily Post in her heyday.
Try not to talk or take a drink of anything while you have food in your mouth. Eat as quietly as possible. It is proper to push your fork against a small piece of bread to assist you in picking up last morsels of food. A small piece of bread may also be used to finish the gravy that is left on your plate.
What would you give for an arbiter such as Emily Post now? In the digital age, in the days of sarcastic emails or Facebook overshares, that first online date, and during election season, a little etiquette, some rules might be a relief. Daniel Post Senning, a chip off the old block of his great-great-grandmother Emily Post, has stepped up to write a new etiquette book for a new age. It's called Emily Post's Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So how did you get around to writing this book?
Well, this book was the absolute obvious first ebook offering from the Emily Post Institute. When we were updating the 17th edition of Etiquette to the 18th edition, I'm a co-author on that, we couldn't isolate the new technology advice to any particular chapter or section. It was pretty apparent as we did that revision that this was impacting every area of our life today, and it really deserved a book of its own.
Do you think your great-grandmother or your great-great?
Two greats. We're okay. A five-generation family business, yes.
Do you think she would embrace the idea of etiquette in the digital age?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Emily was a dynamic woman in her own time. She was a new media maven. She was on the radio. That spectacular introduction that brought this piece together with Emily speaking to movie-going audiences. She loved youth culture. She was a product of that post-World War II era, and even earlier, the flapper generation that preceded World War II. So she was an interesting woman in her own right and appreciated youth culture and new technology.
So one of the lessons is about texting, and sometimes it's better than calling and more polite, and I was wondering, how so? How can that be?
Well, so we often say that maybe your cell phone, for example, it's not rude, it's not polite, it's just how you use it that really matters. And these are just new communication tools. So whenever the form of communication really serves a relationship, it's probably the right choice. So we're hearing from a lot of parents, for example, that they love texting with their teens, that it opens up a whole world of communication. It really brings them into their teens' world. That doesn't mean it's not important to have face-to-face conversations at the dinner table, but by meeting them in their territory, you open up the dialogue in ways that maybe it wasn't before. So that's one example I can think of where texting might really broaden a relationship in unexpected ways.
And email is sort of considered almost formal nowadays compared to all the other ways we communicate, whether it's messaging someone on Facebook or, you know, a message on LinkedIn or, you know, whatever. When is email inappropriate, say, for expressions of sympathy or certain thank you notes?
Sure. So in many ways, emails become the communication medium of business. And so many people use it for business that it sometimes appears a little formal in our world of social media and social networks. So I love to acknowledge that. And I'm sorry, the second part of the question, how one gets in trouble with email or...
Yeah, just with, expressions of sympathy, thank you notes.
Yeah, Absolutely. So for things that are a little more personal than a business message, or when something is of such significance that you really want to give it a little more weight than an electronic form of communication might, a handwritten note, a personal phone call, even a visit is really preferable. And you know, you give a great example, expressions of condolence or sympathy. It might be appropriate to do this through a social network if you're connected to someone sort of tangentially or they're part of your broader circle. But for close friends, family, associates, really giving those personal messages, a personal touch, makes the medium a part of the message itself.
You refer to a healthy digital diet. What do you mean by that?
Well, to me, it's just like when you're learning to eat from the food pyramid, or to put a color rainbow on your plate when you serve yourself. The idea is to sample from a diverse range of communication tools. So, for my grandmother, maybe email is not an effective or appropriate form of communication. For her, the handwritten note is really my best option. For a close friend, it might be a text. For a colleague professionally, it's probably an email. So the diverse communication diet is all about choosing the right tool for the right message and the right relationship.
What's public and what's private when it comes to illness and family problems and so forth? Sometimes I'm really unsure what to do when a Facebook friend who I don't know personally writes about a child who is ill. And they don't say, they say like, they're doing well. The doctors say they're coming out of it. I'm like, coming out of what? And I don't really know who you are. You know, and I know it's because of what I do. I have more people unknown to me, but still, what do you do with that?
Sure. The problem that you describe is a great illustration of the difficulties that can emerge when we are sharing more and more of ourselves with more and more people. And learning to cultivate the same sense of discretion that we cultivate in conversation when we're with each other personally, I think, is a really important skill to cultivate online as well. Sometimes with that electronic brick wall, it's easy to forget that there are other real live people out there that are reading this or seeing this and are impacted and affected by it. So in some ways, it's very generous that people are willing to share more of themselves than just their absolute best resume news. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say that it's only appropriate to put good stuff up
online. A constant Christmas note kind of a thing.
Exactly. At the same time, you want to be careful. Just like in real life, you don't want to be the person in the office that's always complaining or is taking family medical history and bringing it up with everyone you see at the supermarket. I think that thinking about the way you would manage a conversation in those types of public places is a great way to think about how you manage your conversations online and in social media.
So should I ask or should I just ignore it and move on?
You know, that's entirely up to you in terms of how you want to navigate the relationship, but there's nothing inappropriate about ignoring that kind of status update. It doesn't necessarily require a response the same way that an announcement or a personal call about the same illness might.
And by the way, folks, I'm talking with Daniel Post Senning. He's the author of Emily Post's Manners in a Digital World. His middle name is not an accident. His mother, his great-great-grandmother is Emily Post. If you have a question or comment for him about etiquette in a digital age, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. A chapter wasn't enough. He wrote a book. It's called Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. I hate the light key. When people announce sad news, obviously no one is saying that they like the news, but a lot of people click it anyways because they think they want to, it's like a pat on the back or something, but it's so awkward.
Sure. And the redefinition of the English language by Facebook has been problematic for many people. Well, what is a friend these days? Is it someone you're connected to on Facebook? We call those friends. Are they all friends? Do they all have the same weight of relationship? And the answer is obviously no. And the same thing's happened with like, in that in the Facebook world or lexicon, it's really just about a connection or an acknowledgement. But it does create that feeling of, do I want to like bad news? Don't I? It doesn't necessarily mean that you like the bad news, but I can certainly understand the trepidation about clicking it, for sure.
And Facebook just will not relent and give us some kind of,
I think they even tried to copyright like. I'm not sure how successful they were with that. But no, that's one that they're pretty, I think, tied to at this point.
You also, one of the lessons you cover is how to handle a breakup on social media. And I was wondering, first of all, what you're talking about there, and then tell us how to handle it.
Well, mostly we're just trying to help people avoid the really atrocious situation of breaking up with someone in the very public online space, or the very hurt feelings that come from finding out from a Facebook status update that you've been dumped. that really when a relationship
You mean like a romantic type of relationship?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
When a romantic relationship has some emotional significance, someone really they deserve to hear from you personally that you're ending it. And that might be in some cases a phone call. It might be in many cases a personal meeting. If you've gone on several dates with someone, if you've met them face to face, they deserve a face to face parting. At the same time, maybe a phone call is appropriate in certain situations, but the text we're done or the really brutal and sometimes socially difficult situation of being broken up with online and finding out there for the first time is hard for people, and I think they deserve a little more than that.
Well, there's the whole online dating thing anyways, and sometimes you'll read posts on Facebook or maybe on Twitter where someone's referring to, you know, a date gone bad, someone they've met online, and you think, gosh, do you really want to be posting that?
And that jumps back to our question of just a little bit of discretion and having some awareness of who your audience is potentially.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking with a private group, you might share some news about a date that went terribly. At the same time, if that's going up onto your wall and into the stream that all of your friends see, that once again maybe starts to get to the side of you're airing your dirty laundry a little too publicly. You might want to think about the possible repercussions, both with that person and future dates.
You write about the importance of establishing digital house rules, and I'd love to know what those rules are and how you can make every member of the family.
Boy, I wish there was a magic rule that covered everything.
Uh-huh.
Some of the big ones are that you know, sort of implicit in everything that we're saying today is how important the decisions that we make online are. We all recognize that the digital profile that accrues around us over a lifetime is significant, and for many people is part of their employment process, their public life. And from a very young age, from the time that we're children these days, we call today's newest generation digital natives. And as people are growing up in this space, the home is a place where we learn how to navigate that space and navigate it well. So my big rule is that parents need to be involved with their kids, need to be aware of what's going on. I suggest that people keep computers in public spaces in the house as much as possible, and the parents participate with their kids at whatever level they're engaging that digital world or that digital universe in. That's the digital house rule. So it's going to change for your various age groups, but it's all about parental engagement and participation.
You know, when I'm talking to folks on Tech Tuesday about one gadget or another, or one technological development or another, and they'll say, oh, it could be a while. And I'll say, well, how long is it going to be? And they'll say, oh, it could be 3 or 4 weeks. You know, like that's a million years. And I'm wondering, how much shelf life do you think your book has at this point, given the rapidity of change?
You know, it is difficult. You're taking aim at a moving target when you write about anything that's happening online or on the internet. At the same time, a lot of the fundamental messages haven't changed since my great-great-grandmother was giving this kind of advice almost 100 years ago. Think about other people. Be considerate of others. Think about how your actions affect them. And there are golden rules of communication. Before you write something down and send it out in the world, ask yourself, could I take ownership of this if it fell into the wrong hands? Is this something that I would be willing to post on a bulletin board at the office before you put it in a letter? There are some real fundamental ideas about how we treat each other that, whether it's my great-great-grandmother talking about exchanging calling cards or whether it's talking about who you text with today, really don't change. And that the heart of that advice, I think, is really still useful.
Well, Daniel Post-Senning, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
It's my pleasure.
Daniel Post-Senning is the author of Emily Post's Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. Coming up, we'll continue Tech Tuesday when we return. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
After the murder of two Kaufman County prosecutors just a couple of months apart, the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas is among the suspects. The notorious white supremacist gang started in prison. It now operates outside as well. I'm Neil Conan, inside the Aryan Brotherhood, its structure, sources of income, and violent history. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 here on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. 68 degrees with sunshine, warming up to 75 today. Support comes from Ohio State's Department of Neurology, conducting a planned emergency study to see if progesterone can limit the effects of a traumatic brain injury, or TBI. Details on the PROTECT study, including a community opinion survey, and how to opt out of the study are at protectiii.com. And support comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing non-medical home health care and companionship to seniors in Central Ohio for over 16 years. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care. To us, it's personal. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's dangerous and in many states against the law, but smartphones with their many apps are distracting drivers more than ever. Weren't those smart cars supposed to help? Joining us now to talk about that, Troy Wolverton. He's personal technology columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. Welcome back to the show, Troy.
Hi, Ann.
First, let's talk about what spurred the topic in the first place, which was a column by you, I guess, about your own addiction and some of the criticism you received for it. Tell us about that first, because that's more fun.
Right. So I was working on a column. I ended up writing a column about smart cars. There are increasing numbers of options when it comes to smart cars. I had been testing out a new Ford C-Max, which has some kind of smart car options in it. I'd been talking to people at Ford and GM, and I was writing an article about the new smart car technologies. And by smart car technologies, we mean that your car is literally getting smarter in the sense that it's getting processing power of its own and the potential to run applications or to mirror the applications that you have running on your phone. And so I was kind of looking at these technologies, and this is an issue that the car companies are really kind of trying to wrestle with. On the one hand, they want to help consumers to enjoy the content that they have on their phones. They have the sense that consumers want to be able to have similar experiences in their car that they have on their phones. And on the other hand, they're wrestling with this idea that it's really dangerous to be looking at your phone and maybe interacting with these applications in your car. And so I was, interacting with the C-Max car and kind of observing from almost a third-party point of view my own actions in the car and noting that as much as I know it's dangerous and as much as I am aware of the problems with it, that I end up playing with my phone in the car quite often. And, as I'm driving around, I notice quite a few people playing with their phones in the cars.
I'm still not sure I'm more comfortable with that or people putting makeup on while you're driving down the expressway. One way or the other, people will manage to distract themselves if they're bent on it. But are you concerned that the more cars are able to interact with our smart appliances, with our smartphones and so forth, that in the idea is that we'll be hands-free, right? We won't have to be leaning over and adjusting, and we have to actually be holding the phone in our hand. You're suggesting that might not necessarily be all it's cracked up to be, right?
Well, it's not, and there's a couple reasons why. One is that at least some of the early studies that were done on this indicate that even if you're using a hands-free device, if you're talking on the phone, you're still distracted, and that there's little difference in your attention to the road, whether you have the phone pressed against your ear or whether you're talking through a Bluetooth headset. Your mind is in a different space. So that's one piece of this. And the other piece is that in order to have you not staring down at your smartphone screen, car makers are putting more and more screens in the car. And so, for instance, on this C-Max car that I drive, there's a large center console screen where you can get the navigation and everything. And then on either side of the speedometer, there are small screens right in front of you. And I got to tell you, I mean, my eyes were glancing down at those screens, nearly as much or maybe even more than they were staring down at my smartphone. Now maybe you can make the argument that those screens are more readily accessible, and so I don't have to fumble around in my car to look at them, but they're still distracting. And I'm not convinced personally that they're any safer or all that much safer than looking down at a smartphone.
Do you think the big turning point is just going to come when the car drives itself?
Well, that may eventually be the answer, but having a network of self-driving cars is pretty far ways out, I would guess. And so, this is going to be an increasing issue as people, we're already reaching the point where half of Americans have smartphones. You can expect that to go up. And, people have lots of apps that they interact with on those phones. And, as people replace their cars, they're going to be getting cars more and more that have either systems that can interact with their smartphones or systems that are comparable to their smartphones in those cars. And so, this type of technology is coming into the car, and it's going to be an increasing problem, I think.
I think you make an interesting point about whether car companies, given the length of time people tend to keep their cars if they buy them, how they're going to be able to keep up with the development of new phone technology or just the technology in general, whether it's coming by the phone or the iPad or whatever way it's being dished up. What are the car companies thinking about doing, or what are their options going forward?
Well, the car companies are taking, basically two different tacks. In some cases, car companies are trying to make it so that you can more easily use your phone in your car and tap into the applications that are on your phone in your car. In other cases, they are building, full operating systems and capabilities, computing capabilities into the cars themselves and applications that run directly on the cars. And so this is kind of the lines blur between them. In cases where they have the apps running, you can still bring your car into the phone and you can still, plug it in and play Pandora, for instance, or play whatever music is stored locally on the phone. And in cases where you bring your phone in, there are cases where in that model, where they will put connectivity into the car. They'll put a 3G or 4G wireless antenna in the car, and that can be used for basic data functions.
Mm-hmm.
So the lines do blur, but it is kind of a war or an argument going on within the car community about the best way to bring this kind of technology into the car. And there is a growing sense within the automobile industry that not only do consumers want this, but that there are benefits to safety that you can have. If you have cars that can talk to one another, they can give you warnings about where they are in cases where you might not be able to see them visibly, that cars can alert each other to road conditions. So, a car up the road might be able to tell your car that there's rain ahead, and it would know that because the windshield wipers had turned on. And eventually that you could have this type of connectivity and smarts within the car could power a network of self-driving cars.
Which all sounds really exciting. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Troy Wolverton, personal technology columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. We're talking about the idea of smart cars. Do they necessarily rid us of all those distractions that are so dangerous these days with our smartphones and iPods and so forth? Taking that another step further, Troy, is the issue of privacy, too. I want my car talking with just any old car out there? And what if that other car out there is, you know, a law enforcement person who's tracking my speed as well?
Well, sure. And you know, there's kind of two sides to this coin. In many of the different ways that the cars and places the cars might be talking to. So, you know, for instance, insurance companies are already talking about offering discounts to drivers whose who exhibit good driving habits that can be monitored by their cars. And you know, the question is, do you want that? Do you want the insurance companies to be monitoring you? Will that data, because the data is going to be collected, to what extent do we trust that the car companies or whoever is harvesting that data is keeping it anonymous? To what extent, you know, will law enforcement want to subpoena those records or even just ask for the records?
They already do.
From whomever.
They already
right.
do that. Yeah. I mean, no one's stopped them yet.
You know, you're talking about in the near future having a wide network of cars that have very fine-grained data about where you've driven and how you've driven and, you know, what kind of driving you do.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page, post your question or comment there. Talk with Troy Wolverton of the San Jose Mercury News. We have an email from Gretchen. She says that now that using a smartphone while driving in Ohio is illegal, I find myself glancing down at my phone and then panicking and looking around for a police officer. I feel that is more distracting than just holding the phone up to my eyes and reading a quick text or calling my husband. You do have to look at the phone for the second to place a phone call after all. Well, yes and no. I mean, if you have Bluetooth, you don't. But I don't know about you, Troy, but I do not put outgoing calls and my Bluetooth in the car because they just don't understand me. They've got me calling, you know, I want to call my mom. They've got me calling Gretchen. It doesn't make any difference. You know, I mean, what about that?
I would say obey the law, but you know, I obviously, as I freely admitted in my column, don't always obey the law. I do look at my phone in the car. I think that the law is struggling to catch up with what society is doing. And so, you know, one of the interesting things that just happened here in California is we've had a law in California outlawing talking on the phone while driving for a while now. And it was unclear when the law was written whether it was just outlawing talking on the phone or whether, you know, the actual law is written as using your phone while driving.
Hmm.
They came back and wrote a second law that specifically outlaws texting while driving. And there was just a court case that was decided late last month in which the court came down and said, no, using your phone while driving does not just mean talking on the phone. It also means interacting with the phone. So, you know, using your phone for, I think in this particular case, using your phone for navigation and mm-hmm. playing with your phone to type in an address. But, you know, it's interesting, even then, okay, so it's now illegal in California to touch your phone at all, except in the incidental use of dialing a phone number. However, you could think of having, say, an iPod Touch or some kind of music player in the car, and there's nothing forbidding me looking at that screen and touching and interacting with that screen and using it to play music. I mean, the law is, you know, specifically defined as a phone, but it's not just a phone. It's like the computing capabilities. It's all about kind of distraction with electronics rather than just narrowly on a phone.
Yeah, a phone's barely a phone anymore.
Right.
It's many, many more things. You could be taking a picture with it.
Exactly.
Are you, when you got feedback on that column, what kind of feedback did you get? There was quite a bit of anger. I mean, where do you think we're going as a society in general when you write something like that and you get the feedback that you received? What was your feelings about it?
Yeah, I got a lot of feedback from people, and a lot of people were angry at me and at the very idea that people were using their phones in their car. And, you know, they thought that I was countenancing the use of phones in the car. And, you know, I wrote to many of them, I think that my they may have taken me out of context, or maybe I just didn't write it well enough. But, you know, I certainly wasn't trying to encourage people to use their phones while driving. It was more kind of an observation of what I was doing and what I've noted other people doing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people have a right to be. I think on the one hand, people have a right to be upset about it because it is very dangerous. And there are a growing number of people who are getting injured or even killed because people are driving while on their phones or messing around with their smartphones. It clearly is a really distracting behavior. On the other hand, you know, I think that these devices have been engineered to be very compelling devices. They are very difficult to put down. You have to exercise quite a bit of self-control. And you know, they fulfill needs that our cars aren't fulfilling. You know, I don't have, for instance, Pandora in my car. I don't have I don't have any preset music that's in my car, whereas all my entire music library is on my phone. One of my cars doesn't have a GPS device in it. So if I want to get directions to someplace, I basically have to use my phone. So there are reasons, you know, there are reasons why people use these devices in their car, and there are, you know, and probably addictions or something. There's probably some kind of addictive or obsessive compulsive behavior that's embedded in them too.
I put my phone away, and I only take incoming calls. That's my rule. Unless I'm stopped at a stoplight and lost, then I'll get out the map. Dale in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dale.
Yeah, I have a question, which is food for thought. I'm not a young man, but back in the day, I was posed a question, and you have to wait for the answer. What are brakes for? And I think the question relates to technology today when you hear the answer. The answer is, most people would say, to stop. When actually brakes are so you can go faster. And I think the technology today gives people too much leeway. Seatbelts, these things that wake you up when you drift off the road, it makes people less of a driver. And hey, I'm waiting for the day that cars can drive themselves so we don't kill one another on the highway.
Yeah, I just keep picturing that scene in iRobot.
Oh, yeah. Fun ride. Fun ride.
That's an interesting point of view, Dale. I think that's interesting. It probably kind of extrapolates out in the direction of technology very well. You know, why do we have brakes? Because we're driving too fast. It's interesting.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks for that call.
Julie.
What do you say, Troy?
You know, I guess it's an interesting observation.
But that the more technology we have, the harder it is going to be to drive, that it's all, or we're not necessarily going to be safer drivers for it.
Yeah, I mean, the phone in the car is clearly a bad marriage, and I think that the car companies in many cases are trying to make it a better solution, but I don't know that there is a good solution until we get to the day of self-driving cars.
And then,
I think the good solution is the ideal solution is to put the phone away in the car, but many people either aren't going to do that or for various reasons can't do that.
All right. Well, I guess this will probably be a continuing conversation. So, Troy, I hope we'll have you back sometime.
That would be great.
All right. Troy Wolverton, he's personal technology columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. Coming up, Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jarek Bischoff, a composer whose new album heads in an orchestral direction and features guest performers David Byrne, Caetano Veloso, Nels Klein, and others. Bischoff grew up on a sailboat. His father was in an avant-garde rock band. Bischoff has music to play and stories to tell. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. And support our station right now and register to win an iPad mini. Our spring membership drive begins soon, and by making your pledge right now, you'll be automatically entered to win. No pledge is necessary, and entries are only accepted at WOSU.org. The deadline is April 18th. Thanks for your support. 68 degrees with some sunshine, a high of 75 today, a slight chance of showers tonight, and a low near 60. A chance of rain on Wednesday, a high of 77. Support comes from Ohio Northern University, investing in the success of its students by offering more than $58 million in scholarships and financial aid each year. ONU offers nationally ranked academics and a 92% job placement rate. Junior Explore ONU Day is April 20th. Details at onu.edu. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced that his company would be making a big leap into the Android phone market. During the announcement, Zuckerberg asked what a phone would be like if it was designed around people instead of apps. His answer is a new software package called Facebook Home. It is a collection of apps that can change the look and feel of your Android phone. Here to tell us more about Facebook Home and other gadget news is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So how does Facebook Home integrate with an Android phone?
Entirely.
Okay.
It consumes pretty much the entirety of what you see when you start the phone, when you go to launch an application, when you go to send a text message. Facebook Home really consumes the entire front end of your phone in a really interesting way, as long as you are a dedicated Facebook user. If Facebook is, you know, the majority of the thing that you do on a smartphone, or if you've never had a smartphone and Facebook is a dominant part of your social communication, then it could be a really good idea. If you do anything productive on your smartphone, you're probably not going to be a big fan of Facebook Home, because it really does take over a fairly significant part of the experience.
Which I guess is the whole idea when it comes to Facebook, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's not a bad idea. You know, like I said, from the perspective of someone who uses Facebook a lot, and in many ways, I used it for the last couple of days, and I found that you don't even really need to go into the Facebook app anymore. You know, like having Facebook as an app installed is almost unnecessary, because it really does exist, you know, all throughout your phone. When you first turn the phone on, it's almost like your lock screen is a rotating screensaver, a constantly rotating screensaver of posts that that your friends have made. And what was funny was when I installed it on a different phone yesterday, the first post that came up on my Facebook feed was actually one of yours. So it was it's this, you know, scrolling by, you know, wave of messages, and without even having to unlock the phone, if you want to like a message or comment or something, you can do so right from that screen. If you want to launch an app or receive a text message or something like that. Those are all integrated functions into this experience that you basically have without seeing, you know, the Android experience that you have on your phone right now. It's pretty much all wrapped up in this new Facebook experience.
So you're not that big into Facebook though, right?
I'm not a huge Facebook user, but my sister is. She's I spent some time with her and you know, loaded her information onto one of my phones and let her mess with it. And it's great until you go to do something other than interact with Facebook or send a text message.
What happens?
The launcher application that allows you to get to where your apps are it takes away some pretty core functionality from Android. One of the big things on Android is the ability to have widgets. And what that basically does, it takes a part of your desktop and it gives it space to show, you know, maybe the weather or, you know, notifications of some kind. And all of that stuff is gone. So if you use any kind of messaging service that is different from, you know, text messaging or Facebook Messenger, then that experience is hidden entirely. If you get notifications from things like email or any other social network, you really have to be outside of the Facebook home experience to see it and interact with it in the same way. And that causes some problems.
Well, that would be difficult for somebody who's got one foot in the business world and one foot in Facebook, because still a lot of stuff happens via email.
Yeah. So basically the Android notification system, you get that little bar up top and you can pull the bar down and access, you know, your email messages from there.
Mm-hmm.
But it still adds that extra step, you know, when it comes to checking your email. And the email application, you still have to, you have to tap on your icon and then tap on your messages and go to the email application. It's not just sitting there for you to access like you would see on an existing Android phone or even an iPhone, you know, where you can unlock the phone and that's the first thing that you see is, you know, your email thing. And that's what Mark was talking about, you know, having a personal experience instead of an app experience. But I think that in order for that to really be successful, Facebook Home would have to allow some deeper integration with some of the apps that we are kind of still forced to use, like email and you know, communication services from other vendors.
If you're just joining us, it's All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and right now we have Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com, on the air. If you have a question or comment for Russell about just about anything technologically related, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page, post your question or comment there. We're talking right now about the recent announcement that Facebook will be making a big leap into the Android phone market. It's a new software package called Facebook Home, and I guess is it like a collection of apps, Russell, or are you saying it just basically, you said it completely takes over?
It takes over in three pretty critical areas. There's an update to the Facebook app. We talked recently about the Facebook app opening a kind of a dangerous window, and it turns out that this is what that was for.
Okay.
So that when Facebook Home becomes available for your phone, you'll get a pop-up in the Facebook store that says, hey, all you need to do is, you know, push this button here and you'll get what you need. And it'll download the stuff for Facebook Home. And an instant messaging service that I really think it's really a shame that this only works for Facebook Home and for SMS messages, because it's really a fantastic service that they have. It's called Chathead. And they do this kind of silly thing where they're demonstrating how it was working. But basically, if you get a message, it doesn't matter what you're doing on your phone. If you're looking at email or something like that, you get this little tiny bubble, which is the icon of the person who sent you a message. And it can either be a Facebook message or a text message. And that notification is persistent. You can take it and you can move it to the other side of the screen until you're finished what you're doing. But it's always floating on the top of the screen. And you can interact with it and keep having a conversation with someone and never have to leave the application that you're in, never have to leave the task that you're completing to keep having that conversation. And I found that a really great way to do that.
Except that no matter who's sending you that message via Facebook, it's gonna be persistent.
Yeah, anytime you get a message from somebody, it's going to pop up. So if you get a lot of activity, you know, during the day and you don't want it to be there, you pretty much have to disable, you know, the notification service. So it's, you get, you know, kind of a plus and minus there.
So if you're on an iPhone, this is not going to be an issue for you. They're not going to be asking you to sign up for this.
It is impossible to replicate this experience on the iPhone. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing has yet to be determined. It really depends on how popular the service is. But the way that Apple maintains their ecosystem, because Apple controls all of that stuff, the front end and everything, it's impossible to recreate this on an iPhone or on an iPad. So that's just not even going
to
happen.
Which explains why Android wants to get involved, because this is a way, if it's something different and...
Yeah, huge differentiator. I mean, you will not be able to compare the two experiences, you know, once this stuff comes out, especially since on top of having the service available for most of the high-end phones, you know, that are available and the ones that are coming out in the next month, they're also going to have their own piece of hardware called the HTC First that'll actually be sold running the software.
Okay, so when is it coming out?
The HTC First will be available next week, sold exclusively through AT&T for $100 on a new contract.
Okay.
And it's a small, you know, it's a smallish HTC phone. It comes in four different colors, and it is, you know, Facebook right out of the gate. You know, as soon as you turn it on, you log into Facebook, and if you want to log into, you know, Google applications later, you certainly can. But it's, you know, it's very much a Facebook experience tonight.
And Facebook Home, in and of itself, there won't be a price tag, right?
No, Facebook Home itself is going to be free. It's going to be available for any hardware manufacturer to allow to be installed on their phone, and that's essentially how that's going to work. Is, you know, it has to be approved, but it you know, certainly seems like an impressive leap forward, as long as, you know, it's approaching the correct market. I know that it's not something I can use, even though it is, you know, visually really appealing.
Uh-huh.
I'm just not that big a Facebook user. But if there are users out there, if there are enough users out there who are just, you know, the Facebook experience is their dominant communication platform, then this could be a really positive thing.
All right. So there's got to be a price. I mean, what's the other shoe that's going to drop? Is it going to just be a constant ad,
I mean,
stream,
it's
or what?
It's Facebook. So I mean, you get the same experience that you get from your existing Facebook experience, which includes ad delivery. It's not going to be right away, because the ads have to be kind of formatted to that Facebook Home experience.
Mm-hmm.
But that'll certainly be a part of it, because Facebook views advertisements and you know, what they call promoted posts as content. You know, so it's all exactly the same experience. So yeah, having a Facebook phone will mean, you know, having ads delivered to you on your phone in gigantic images across your lock screen, and possibly even, you know, with their new paid messaging service, having them able to reach out and communicate with you directly.
Ugh. now, all right, is Facebook paid Android, or is Android paying Facebook, or what's their relationship? Do we know?
Oh, neither. As a matter of fact, Google and Facebook have never had a particularly nice relationship because neither one of them really want to share data with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Because Android is in and of itself an open source platform, and the core parts of what Facebook Home is interacting with are all the open source parts, there's not even any real interaction between the two companies that are necessary. You know, this is all stuff that you Facebook as a company can download from Google for free and modify and then release as their own software.
What will they think of next? Windows XP. What's going on with support for Microsoft operating systems with Windows XP? What's happening there?
Microsoft promises that they are serious this time in their statement that in 363 days, I think it is now, Windows XP will no longer be officially supported by Microsoft.
What does that mean?
That means that when there are, you know, virus definitions that need to be updated, or exploits that are found in Windows XP, or security patches that apply to Windows kind of universally, they will not be released for Windows XP.
So how many people does this really affect, do you think?
it decreases on a really kind of constant basis as major companies are updating from Windows XP, because XP in and of itself, the first release of XP is now over a decade old.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people are moving on to Windows 7, and I think Microsoft would really like them to move on to Windows 8, but that's probably not happening just quite yet.
Is this just like someone deciding they're not going to make a part for a car anymore because not enough people are demanding it?
I think it's part of that, and also part of, you know, it's expensive for them to have an entire Windows XP team for software that they really don't want people to use anymore.
And if you're happy with XP, if you like being back there, what are the drawbacks of not switching? What would it be like?
Yeah, you're just going to slowly lose support for software that gets released. You know, right now, Microsoft does a pretty good job keeping that kind of software up to date. But if something like, a Java exploit that, you know, could really take over your system, which happens on a pretty regular basis, gets released, Microsoft isn't going to do anything to fix it. So you're going to be exposed pretty much forever.
Let's switch gears again. You recently wrote about online piracy from the content creator's point of view, your own point of view. What was your experience? What happened?
It was just kind of a weird thing that happened. It was pointed out to me a while after my book was released that it was available to download from a piracy source. And it just kind of it made me sit back and think for a while about, you know, why it is something like that would happen. And more importantly, why it would happen to me, because my book is really more of a reference manual than it was, you know, entertainment. Which, you know, from my perspective was usually, you know, the reason that kind of thing happened. And it caused me to think about, you know, what the actual, you know, pros and cons of having content that you've produced to be pirated was. And the first, you know, a lot of people look at it like, you know, well, at least they're reading it, or at least they're, you know, watching it or listening to it. And that's certainly true, but it caused me to also pay attention to the fact that there's no feedback there. You know, I've never had someone come to me and say, you know, hey, I didn't have the $15 to get your book, so I downloaded it, and this is what I thought about it.
They're not going to talk to you.
Right. So it causes kind of an odd feedback thing, and I don't think that I would respond negatively if somebody came to me with feedback for something, even though they hadn't paid for it. But it caused me to really take a look at, you know, the entire spectrum of what's missing. It's not just, you know, the money that wasn't received. It was, you know, the entire experience that goes along with that. I now have no idea how many people have read the book or what this entire group of people thought of it.
Well, sometimes that's good, but and you said it's more of a reference manual than for entertainment. But is it at all for entertainment? I guess I'm trying to see if I figure.
Not really. I mean, it was really. You know, it was about using Android tablets and you know, kind of it's actually mostly out of date now because Android has grown a full version since mm-hmm. I published it. So it was just kind of an interesting thing. And my editor, had recently published a book as well. And he noticed that, you know, the exact same thing that, you know, the book had been pirated. And his book was about, you know, LED lighting, you know, so it was, again, not specifically for entertainment, but it was an interesting, you know, experience to see, you know, how each of us responded to that just a little bit differently.
Does it affect whether you'll write another one?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
It may affect the publisher that I write through just because, you know, I got some people who said, you know, well, the book wasn't available in the format that I wanted. When I went to the publisher, they said, well, that takes time. So we didn't do that.
Okay.
So that, you know, that may have a bearing just so it's available in more places, but it certainly isn't going to stop me from writing.
Russell Holley. Hopefully it won't stop you from joining us every Tuesday.
Absolutely not.
Russell Holley, he is tech blogger for geek.com. Thanks for listening today. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.